Ford and Carter in Philadelphia. Here is NBC News correspondent David Brinkley.
The two debaters, no doubt a little nervous, are in place. The house lights are dimmed. The audience is in the seats, under instructions to do nothing but watch, listen, and be quiet. It might be said the campaign for president now begins, probably before the biggest audience ever to see any political event. Maybe 90 to 100 million in this country who can vote for one of the two debaters, and some millions more abroad who can't. And depending on how it goes, it's entirely possible the 1976 election will be won and lost here tonight. It will last 90 minutes. Three reporters will ask the questions. There are time limits on the answers. No notes or prepared speeches allowed. The moderator is Edwin Newman of NBC News.
Moderator of this first debate of the 1976 campaign between Gerald R. Ford of Michigan, Republican candidate for president, and Jimmy Carter of Georgia, Democratic candidate for president. We thank you, President Ford, and we thank you, Governor Carter, for being with us tonight. There are to be three debates between the presidential candidates and one between the vice presidential candidates. All are being arranged by the League of Women Voters Education Fund. Tonight's debate, the first between presidential candidates in 16 years, and the first ever in which an incumbent president has participated, is taking place before an audience in the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia, just three blocks from Independence Hall. The television audience may reach 100 million in the United States and many millions overseas. Tonight's debate focuses on domestic issues and economic policy. Questions will be put by Frank Reynolds of ABC News, James Gannon of the Wall Street Journal, and Elizabeth Drew of the New Yorker magazine. Under the agreed rules, the first question will go to Governor Carter. That was decided by the toss of a coin. He will have up to 3 minutes to answer. One follow-up question will be permitted with up to 2 minutes to reply. President Ford will then have 2 minutes to respond. The next question will go to President Ford with the same time arrangements, and questions will continue to be alternated between the candidates. Each man will make a 3-minute statement at the end, Governor Carter to go first. President Ford and Governor Carter do not have any notes or prepared remarks with them this evening. Mr. Reynolds, your question for Governor Carter.
Mr. President, Governor Carter. Governor, in an interview with the Associated Press last week, you said you believe these debates would alleviate a lot of concern that some voters have about you. Well, one of those concerns, not an uncommon one about candidates in any year, is that many voters say they don't really know where you stand. Now, you have made jobs your number one priority, and you have said you are committed to a drastic reduction in unemployment. Can you say now, Governor, in specific terms, what your first step would be next January if you were elected to achieve that?
Yes. First of all, is to recognize the tremendous economic strength of this country, and to set the putting back to work of our people as a top priority. This is an effort that ought to be done primarily by strong leadership in the White House, the inspiration of our people, the tapping of business, agriculture, industry, labor, and government at all levels to work on this project. We'll never have an end to the inflationary spiral, and we'll never have a balanced budget until we get our people back to work. There are several things that can be done specifically that are not now being done. First of all, to channel research and development funds into areas that will provide large numbers of jobs. Secondly, we need to have a commitment in the private sector to cooperate with government in matters like housing. Here, a very small investment of taxpayers' money in the housing field can bring large numbers of extra jobs in the guarantee of mortgage loans, and the putting forward of 202 programs for housing for older people and so forth to cut down the roughly 20% unemployment that now exists in the construction industry. Another thing is to deal with our needs in the central cities, where the unemployment rate is extremely high, sometimes among minority groups, those who don't speak English or who are black, young people, 40% unemployment. Here, a CCC-type program would be appropriate to channel money into the sharing with private sector and also local and state governments to employ young people who are now out of work. Another very important aspect of our economy would be to increase production in every way possible, to hold down taxes on individuals, and to shift the tax burdens onto those who have avoided paying taxes in the past. These kinds of specific things, none of which are being done now, would be a great help in reducing unemployment. There is an additional factor that needs to be done and covered very, very succinctly, and that is to make sure that we have a good relationship between management, business on the one hand, and labor on the other. In a lot of places where unemployment is very high, we might channel specific targeted job opportunities by paying part of the salary of unemployed people and also sharing with local governments the payment of salaries, which would let us cut down the unemployment rate much lower before we hit the inflationary level. But I believe that by the end of the first 4 years of the next term, we can have the unemployment rate down to 3% adult unemployment, which is about 4 to 4.5% overall, controlled inflation rate, and have a balance of growth of about 4 to 6%, around 5%, which would give us a balanced budget.
Governor, in the event you are successful and you do achieve a drastic drop in unemployment that is likely to create additional pressure on prices, how willing are you to consider an incomes policy, in other words, wage and price controls?
Well, we now have such a low utilization of our productive capacity, about 73%, I think it's about the lowest since the Great Depression years, and such a high unemployment rate now, 7.9%, that we have a long way to go in getting people to work before we have the inflationary pressures. And I think this would be easy to accomplish, to get jobs down without having the strong inflationary pressures that would be necessary. I would not favor the payment of a given fixed income to people unless they are not able to work. But with tax incentives for the low-income groups, we could build up their income levels above the poverty level and not make welfare more profitable than work.
Mr. President, your response?
I don't believe that Mr. Carter has been any more specific in this case than he has been on many other instances. I noticed particularly that he didn't endorse the Humphrey Hawkins bill, which he has on occasions, and which is included as a part of the Democratic platform. That legislation allegedly would help our unemployment, but we all know that it would have controlled our economy. It would have added $10 to $30 billion each year in additional expenditures by the federal government. It would have called for export controls on agricultural products. In my judgment, the best way to get jobs is to expand the private sector, where 5 out of 6 jobs today exist in our economy. We can do that by reducing federal taxes, as I proposed about a year ago when I called for a tax reduction of $28 billion. 3/4 of it to go to private taxpayers and 1/4 to the business sector. We could add to jobs in the major metropolitan areas by a proposal that I recommended that would give tax incentives to business to move into the inner city and to expand or to build new plants so that they would take a plant or expand a plant where people are and people are currently unemployed. We could also help our youth with some of the proposals that would give to young people an opportunity to work and learn at the same time, just like we give money to young people who are going to college. Those are the kind of specifics that I think we have to discuss on these debates. And these are the kind of programs that I'll talk about on my time.
Mr. Gannon, your question to President Ford.
Mr. President, I would like to continue for a moment on this question of taxes, which you have just raised. You have said that you favor more tax cuts for middle-income Americans, even those earning up to $30,000 a year. That presumably would cost the Treasury quite a bit of money in lost revenue. In view of the very large budget deficits that you have accumulated and that are still in prospect, How is it possible to promise further tax cuts and to reach your goal of balancing the budget?
At the time, Mr. Gannon, that I made the recommendation for a $28 billion tax cut, three-quarters of it to go to individual taxpayers and 25% to American business, I said at the same time that we had to hold the lid on federal spending, that for every dollar of a tax reduction, we had to have an equal reduction in federal expenditures, a one-for-one proposition. And I recommended that to the Congress with a budget ceiling of $395 billion, and that would have permitted us to have a $28 billion tax reduction. In my tax reduction program for middle-income taxpayers, I recommended that the Congress increase personal exemptions from $750 per person to $1,000 per person. That would mean, of course, that for a family of four, that family would have $1,000 more personal exemption, money that they could spend for their own purposes, money that the government wouldn't have to spend. But if we keep the lid on federal spending, which I think we can with the help of the Congress, we can justify fully a $28 billion tax reduction. In the budget that I submitted to the Congress in January of this year, I recommended a 50% cutback in the rate of growth of federal spending. For the last 10 years, the budget of the United States has grown from about 11% per year. We can't afford that kind of growth in federal spending. And in the budget that I recommended, we cut it in half, a growth rate of 5 to 5.5%. With that kind of limitation on federal spending, we can fully justify the tax reductions that I have proposed. And it seems to me, with the stimulant of more money in the hands of the taxpayer, and with more money in the hands of business to expand, to modernize, to provide more jobs, our economy will be stimulated so that we'll get more revenue and we'll have a more prosperous economy.
Mr. President, to follow up a moment, the Congress has passed a tax bill, which is before you now, which did not meet exactly the sort of outline that you requested. What is your intention on that bill, since it doesn't meet your requirements? Do you plan to sign that bill?
That tax bill does not entirely meet the criteria that I established. I think the Congress should have added another $10 billion reduction in personal income taxes, including the increase of personal exemptions from $750 to $1,000. And Congress could have done that if the budget committees of the Congress and the Congress as a whole had not increased the spending that I recommended in the budget. I'm sure you know that in the resolutions passed by the Congress, they have added about $17 billion in more spending by the Congress over the budget that I recommended. So I would prefer in that tax bill to have an additional tax cut and a further limitation on federal spending. Now, this tax bill that hasn't reached the White House yet, but is expected in a day or two, it's about 1,500 pages. It has some good provisions in it. It has left out some that I have recommended, unfortunately. On the other hand, when you have a bill of that magnitude, with those many provisions, a president has to sit and decide if there's more good than bad. And from the analysis that I've made so far, it seems to me that that tax bill does justify my signature and my approval.
Governor Carter, your response?
Well, Mr. Ford is changing considerably his previous philosophy. The present tax structure is a disgrace to this country. It's just a welfare program for the rich. As a matter of fact, 25% of the total tax deductions go for only 1% of the richest people in this country. And over 50% of the tax credits go for the 14% of the richest people in this country. When Mr. Ford first became president in August of 1974, the first thing he did in October was to ask for a $4.7 billion increase in taxes on our people in the midst of the heaviest recession since the Great Depression of the 1940s. In January of 1975, he asked for a tax change, a $5.6 billion increase on low and middle income private individuals, a $6.5 billion decrease on the corporations and the special interests. In December of 1975, he vetoed the roughly $18 to $20 billion tax reduction bill that had been passed by the Congress. And then he came back later on in January of this year, and he did advocate a $10 billion tax reduction, but it would be offset by a $6 billion increase this coming January in deductions for Social Security payments and for unemployment compensation. The whole philosophy of the Republican Party, including my opponent, has been to pile on taxes on low-income people to take them off on the corporations. As a matter of fact, since the late 60s, when Mr. Nixon took office, we've had a reduction in the percentage of taxes paid by corporations from 30% down to about 20%. We've had an increase in taxes paid by individuals, payroll taxes, from 14% up to 20%. And this is what the Republicans have done to us. And this is why tax reform is so important.
Mrs. Drew, your question to Governor Carter.
Governor Carter, you've proposed a number of new or enlarged programs, including jobs, health, welfare reform, child care, aid to education, aid to cities, changes in Social Security, housing subsidies. You've also said that you want to balance the budget by the end of your first term. Now, you haven't put a price tag on those programs, but even if we price them conservatively, and we count for full employment by the end of your first term, and we count for the economic growth that would occur during that period, there still isn't enough money to pay for those programs and balance the budget by any estimates that I've been able to see. So in that case, what would give?
Well, as a matter of fact, there is. If we assume the a rate of growth of our economy equivalent to what it was during President Johnson, President Kennedy, even before the Vietnamese War, and if we assume that at the end of the four-year period, we can cut our unemployment rate down to 4 to 4.5%, under those circumstances, even assuming no elimination of unnecessary programs and assuming an increase in the allotment of money to finance programs, increasing as the inflation rate does, my economic projections, I think confirmed by the House and the Senate committees, have been with a $60 billion extra amount of money that can be spent in fiscal year 81, which would be the last year of this next term. Within that $60 billion increase, they would be fit the programs that I promised the American people. I might say, too, that if we see that these goals cannot be reached, and I believe they're reasonable goals, then I would cut back on the rate of implementation of new programs in order to accommodate a balanced budget by fiscal year 81. Which is the last year of the next term. I believe that we ought to have a balanced budget during normal economic circumstances. And these projections have been very carefully made. I stand behind them. And if they should be in error slightly on the downside, then I'll phase in the programs that we've advocated more slowly.
Governor, according to the budget committees of the Congress that you referred to, if we get to full employment, what they project at a 4% unemployment, and as you say, even allowing for the inflation in the programs, there would not be anything more than a surplus of $5 billion by the end of by 1981. And conservative estimates of your programs would be that they'd be about $85 to $100 billion. So how do you say that you're going to be able to do these things and balance the budget?
Well, the assumption that you have described is different. Is in the rate of growth of our economy.
No, they took that into account in those figures.
I believe that it's accurate to say that the committees to whom you refer, with the employment rate that you state, and with the 5 to 5.5% growth rate in our economy, that the projections would be a $60 billion increase in the amount of money that we have to spend in 1981 compared to now. And with that, in that framework, would be fit any improvements in the programs. Now, this does not include extra control over unnecessary spending, the weeding out of obsolete or obsolescent programs. We'll have a safety version built in with complete reorganization of the executive branch of government, which I am pledged to do. The present bureaucratic structure of the federal government is a mess. And if I'm elected president, that's going to be a top priority of mine to completely revise the structure of the federal government to make it economical, efficient, purposeful, and manageable for a change. And also, I'm going to institute zero-based budgeting, which I used 4 years in Georgia, which assesses every program every year and eliminates those programs that are obsolete or obsolescent. But with these projections, we will have a balanced budget by fiscal year 1981 if I'm elected president. Keep my promises to the American people. And it's just predicated on very modest, but I think accurate projections of employment increases and a growth in our national economy equal to what was experienced under Kennedy and Johnson before the Vietnam War.
President Ford.
If it is true that there will be a $60 billion surplus by fiscal year 1981, rather than spend that money for all the new programs that Governor Carter recommends and endorses, and which are included in the Democratic platform, I think the American taxpayer ought to get an additional tax break, a tax reduction of that magnitude. I feel that the taxpayers are the ones that need the relief. I don't think we should add additional programs of the magnitude that Governor Carter talks about. It seems to me that our tax structure today has rates that are too high. But I am very glad to point out that since 1969, during a Republican administration, we have had 10 million people taken off of the tax rolls at the lower end of the taxpayer area. And at the same time, assuming that I sign the tax bill that was mentioned by Mr. Gannon, we will, in the last two tax bills, have increased the minimum tax on all wealthy taxpayers. And I believe that by eliminating 10 million taxpayers in the last 8 years, and by putting a heavier tax burden on those in the higher tax brackets, plus the other actions that have been taken, we can give taxpayers adequate tax relief. Now, it seems to me that as we look at the recommendations of the budget committees and our own projections, there isn't going to be any $60 billion dividend. I've heard of those dividends in the past. It always happens. We expected one at the time of the Vietnam War, but it was used up before we ever ended the war, and taxpayers never got the adequate relief they deserved.
Mr. Reynolds?
Mr. President, when you came into office, you spoke very eloquently of the need for a time for healing. And very early in your administration, you went out to Chicago and you announced, you proposed a program of case-by-case pardons for draft resistors to restore them to full citizenship. Some 14,000 young men took advantage of your offer, but another 90,000 did not. In granting the pardon to former President Nixon, sir, part of your rationale was to put Watergate behind us, to, if I may quote you again, truly end our long national nightmare. Why does not the same rationale apply now, today, in our bicentennial year, to the young men who resisted in Vietnam and many of them still in exile abroad?
The amnesty program that I recommended in Chicago in September of 1974 would give to all draft evaders and military deserters the opportunity to earn their good record back. About 14 to 15,000 did take advantage of that program. We gave them ample time. I am against an across-the-board pardon of draft evaders or military deserters. Now, in the case of Mr. Nixon, the reason the pardon was given was that when I took office, this country was in a very, very divided condition. There was hatred, there was divisiveness. People had lost faith in their government in many, many respects. Mr. Nixon resigned, and I became president. It seemed to me that if I was to adequately and effectively handle the problems of high inflation, a growing recession, the involvement of the United States still in Vietnam, that I had to give 100% of my time to those two major problems. Mr. Nixon resigned. That is disgrace. The first president out of 38 that ever resigned from public office under pressure. So when you look at the penalty that he paid, and when you analyze the requirements that I had to spend all of my time working on the economy, which was in trouble, that I inherited, working on our problems in Southeast Asia, which were still plaguing us, it seemed to me that Mr. Nixon had been penalized enough by his resignation in disgrace, and the need and necessity for me to concentrate on the problems of the country fully justified the action that I took.
Well, I take it then, sir, that you do not believe that that you are going to reconsider and think about those 90,000 who are still abroad. Have they not been penalized enough? Many of them have been there for years.
Well, Mr. Carter has indicated that he would give a blanket pardon to all draft evaders. I do not agree with that point of view. I gave, in September of 1974, an opportunity for all draft evaders, all deserters, to come in voluntarily, clear their records by earning an opportunity to restore their good citizenship. I think we gave them a good opportunity. I don't think we should go any further.
Governor Carter?
Well, I think it's very difficult for President Ford to explain the difference between the pardon of President Nixon and his attitude toward those who violated the draft laws. As a matter of fact, you know, I don't advocate amnesty. I advocate pardon. There's a difference, in my opinion, and according to the ruling of the Supreme Court and according to the definition in the dictionary. Amnesty means that what you did was right. Pardon means that what you did, whether it's right or wrong, you're forgiven for it. And I do advocate a pardon for draft evaders. I think it's accurate to say that in 2 years ago when Mr. Ford put in this amnesty, that three times as many deserters were excused as were the ones who evaded the draft. But I think that now is the time to heal our country after the Vietnam War. And I think that what the people are concerned about is not the pardon or the amnesty of those who evaded the draft, but whether or not our crime system is fair. We've got a sharp distinction drawn between white-collar crime. The big shots who are rich, who are influential, very seldom go to jail. Those who are poor and who have no influence are quite often the ones who are punished. And the whole subject of crime is one that concerns our people very much. And I believe that the fairness of it is a major problem that addresses our leader. And this is something that hasn't been addressed adequately by this administration. But I hope to have a complete responsibility on my shoulders to help bring about a fair criminal justice system, and also to bring about an end to the divisiveness that has occurred in our country as a result of the Vietnam War.
Mr. Gannon?
Governor Carter, you have promised a sweeping overhaul of the federal government, including a reduction in the number of government agencies. You say it would go down to about 200 from some 1,900. That sounds indeed like a very deep cut in the federal government. But isn't it a fact that you're not really talking about fewer federal employees or less government spending, but rather that you are talking about reshaping the federal government, not making it smaller?
Well, I've been through this before, Mr. Cannon, as the governor of Georgia. When I took over, we had a bureaucratic mess like we have in Washington now. And we had 300 agencies, departments, bureaus, commissions, some fully budgeted, some not, but all having responsibility to carry out that was in conflict. And we cut those 300 agencies and so forth down substantially. We eliminated 278 of them. We set up a simple structure of government that could be administered fairly. And it was a tremendous success. It hasn't been undone since I was there. It resulted also in an ability to reshape our court system, our prison system, our education system, our mental health programs, and a clear assignment of responsibility and authority, and also to have our people once again understand and control our government. I intend to do the same thing if I'm elected president. When I get to Washington, coming in as an outsider, one of the major responsibilities that I will have on my shoulder is a complete reorganization of the executive branch of government. We now have a greatly expanded White House staff. When Mr. Nixon went in office, for instance, we had $3.5 million spent on the White House and its staff. That has escalated now to $16.5 million in the last Republican administration. This needs to be changed. We need to put the responsibilities back on the cabinet members. We also need to have a great reduction in agencies and programs. For instance, we now have in the health area 302 different programs administered by 11 major departments and agencies, 60 other advisory commissions responsible for this. Medicaid's in one agency, Medicare's in a different one. The check on the quality of health care is in a different one. None of them are responsible for health care itself. This makes it almost impossible for us to have a good health program. We have just advocated this past week a consolidation of the responsibilities for energy. Our country now has no comprehensive energy program or policy. We have 20 different agencies in the federal government responsible for the production, the regulation, the information about energy, the conservation of energy, spread all over government.